Chapter 28. Vinicus received no answer to this letter. Petronius did not write, thinking evidently that Caesar might command a return to Rome any day. In fact, news of it was spread in the city, and roused great delight in the hearts of the rabble, eager for games with gifts of grain and olives, great supplies of which had been accumulated in Ostia. Helius, Nero's freedman, announced at last the return in the Senate. But Nero, having embarked with his court on ships at Misenum, returned slowly, disembarking at coast towns for rest, or exhibitions in theaters. He remained between 10 and 20 days in Minturna, and even thought to return to Naples and wait there for spring, which was earlier than usual, and warm. During all this time Vinicius lived shut up in his house, thinking of Lygia, and all those new things which occupied his soul, and brought to it ideas and feelings foreign to it thus far. He saw, from time to time, only Glaucus the physician, every one of whose visits delighted him, for he could converse with the man about Lygia. Glaucus knew not, it is true, whereas he had found refuge, but he gave assurance that the elders were protecting her with watchful care. Once too, when moved by the sadness of Vinicius, he told him that Peter had blamed Crispus for reproaching Lygia with her love. The young patrician, hearing this, grew pale from emotion. He had thought more than once that Lygia was not indifferent to him, but he fell into frequent doubt and uncertainty. Now for the first time he heard the confirmation of his desires and hopes from strange lips, and, besides, those of a Christian. At the first moment of gratitude he wished to run to Peter. When he learned, however, that he was not in the city, but teaching in the neighborhood, he implored Glaucus to accompany him thither, promising to make liberal gifts to the poor community. It seemed to him, too, that if Lygia loved him, all obstacles were thereby set aside, as he was ready at any moment to honor Christ. Glaucus, though he urged him persistently to receive baptism, would not venture to assure him that he would gain Lygia at once, and said that it was necessary to desire the religion for its own sake, through love of Christ, not for other objects. Oh, one must have a Christian soul too, said he. And Vinicius, though every obstacle angered him, had begun to understand that Glaucus, as a Christian, said what he ought to say. He had not become clearly conscious that one of the deepest changes in his nature was this, that formerly he had measured people and things only by his own self-imus, but now he was accustoming himself gradually to the thought that other eyes might see differently, other hearts feel differently, and that justice did not mean always the same as personal profit. He wished often to see Paul of Tarsus, whose discourse made him curious and disturbed him. He arranged in his mind arguments to overthrow his teaching, he resisted him in thought, still he wished to see him, and to hear him. Paul, however, had gone to Arisium, and, since the visits of Glaucus had become rarer, Vinicius was in perfect solitude. He began again to run through back streets adjoining the Subura, and narrow lanes of the Trans-Tiber, in the hope that even from a distance he might see Lygia. When even that hope failed him, weariness and impatience began to rise in his heart. At last the time came when his former nature was felt again mightily, like that onrush of a wave to the shore from which it had receded. It seemed to him that he had been a fool to no purpose, that he had stuffed his head with things which brought sadness, that he ought to accept from life what it gives. He resolved to forget Lygia, or at least to seek pleasure and the use of things aside from her. He felt that this trial, however, was the last, and he threw himself into it with all the blind energy of impulse peculiar to him. Life itself seemed to urge him to this course. The city, torpid and depopulated by winter, began to revive with hope of the near coming of Caesar. A solemn reception was in waiting for him. Meanwhile, spring was there. The snow on the Alban hills had vanished under the breath of winds from Africa. Grass plots in the gardens were covered with violets. The forums and the Campus Martius were filled with people warmed by a sun of growing heat. Along the Appian Way, the usual place for drives outside the city, a movement of richly ornamented chariots had begun. excursions were made to the Alban Hills. Youthful women, under pretext of worshipping Juno in Lanuvium, or Diana in Aricia, left home to seek adventures, society, meetings, and pleasure beyond the city. Here Vinicius saw one day among lordly chariots the splendid car of Chrysothemis, preceded by two Molossian dogs. It was surrounded by a crowd of young men, and by old senators, whose position detained them in the city. Chrysothemis, driving four Corsican ponies herself, scattered smiles round about, and light strokes of a golden whip. But when she saw Vinicius she reined in her horses, took him into her car, and then to a feast at her house, which lasted all night. At that feast Vinicius drank, so much that he did not remember when they took him home. He recollected, however, that when Chrysothemis mentioned Lygia he was offended, and, being drunk, emptied a goblet of Falernian on her head. When he thought of this in soberness, he was angrier still. But a day later Chrysothemis, forgetting evidently the injury, visited him at his house, and took him to the Appian Way a second time. Then she supped at his house, and confessed that not only Petronius, but his lute player, had grown tedious to her long since, and that her heart was free now. They appeared together for a week, but the relation did not promise permanence. After the Falernian incident, however, Lygia's name was never mentioned, but Vinicius could not free himself from thoughts of her. He had the feeling always that her eyes were looking at his face, and that feeling filled him, as it were, with fear. He suffered, and could not escape the thought that he was saddening Lygia, or the regret which that thought roused in him. After the first scene of jealousy which Chrysothemis made, because of two Syrian damsels whom he purchased, he let her go in rude fashion. He did not cease at once from pleasure and license, it is true, but he followed them out of spite, as it were, toward Lygia. At last he saw that the thought of her did not leave him for an instant, that she was the one cause of his evil activity as well as his good, and that really nothing in the world occupied him except her. Disgust, and then weariness, mastered him. Pleasure had grown loathsome, and left mere reproaches. It seemed to him that he was wretched, and this last feeling filled him with measureless astonishment, for formerly he recognized as good everything which pleased him. Finally, he lost freedom, self-confidence, and fell into perfect torpidity, from which even the news of Caesar's coming could not rouse him. Nothing touched him, and he did not visit Petronius till the latter sent an invitation and his litter. On seeing his uncle, though greeted with gladness, he replied to his questions unwillingly, but his feelings and thoughts, repressed for a long time, burst forth at last, and flowed from his mouth in a torrent of words. Once more he told in detail the history of his search for Lygia, his life among the Christians, everything which he had heard and seen there, everything which had passed through his head and heart, and finally he complained that he had fallen into a chaos, in which were lost composure and the gift of distinguishing and judging. Nothing, he said, attracted him, nothing was pleasing. He did not know what to hold to, nor how to act. He was ready both to honor and persecute Christ. He understood the loftiness of his teaching, but he felt also an irresistible repugnance to it. He understood that, even should he possess Lygia, he would not possess her completely, for he would have to share her with Christ. Finally, he was living, as if not living, without hope, without a morrow, without belief in happiness. Around him was darkness in which he was groping for an exit, and could not find it. Petronius, during this narrative, looked at his changed face, at his hands, which while speaking he stretched forth in a strange manner, as if actually seeking a road in the darkness, and he fell to thinking. All at once he rose, and, approaching Vinicius, caught with his fingers the hair above his ear. "Dost know," asked he, "that thou hast gray hairs on thy temple?" "Perhaps I have," answered Vinicius. "I should not be astonished were all my hair to grow white soon." Silence followed. Petronius was a man of sense, and more than once he meditated on the soul of man and on life. In general, life, and the society in which they both lived might be happy or unhappy externally, but internally it was at rest. Just as a thunderbolt or an earthquake might overturn a temple, so might misfortune crush a life. In itself, however, it was composed of simple and harmonious lines, free of complication. But there was something else in the words of Vinicius, and Petronius stood for the first time before a series of spiritual snarls which no one had straightened out hitherto. H.C. was sufficiently a man of reason to feel their importance, but with all his quickness he could not answer the questions put to him. After a long silence, he said at last, "These must be enchantments." "I too have thought so," answered Vinicius. "More than once it seemed to me that we were enchanted, both of us." "And if thou," said Petronius, "were to go, for example, to the priests of Serapis? Among them, as among priests in general, there are many deceivers, no doubt, but there are others who have reached wonderful secrets." He said this, however, without conviction and with an uncertain voice, for he himself felt how empty, and even ridiculous, that counsel must seem on his lips. Vinicius rubbed his forehead, and said, "Enchantments. I have seen sorcerers who employed unknown and subterranean powers to their personal profit. I have seen those who used them to the harm of their enemies. But these Christians live in poverty, forgive their enemies, preach submission, virtue, and mercy. What profit could they get from enchantments, and why should they use them?" Petronius was angry that his acuteness could find no reply. Not wishing, however, to acknowledge this, he said, so as to offer an answer of some kind, "Had it a new sect?" After a while he added, "By the divine dweller in Paphian groves, how all that injures life. Thou wilt admire the goodness and virtue of those people, but I tell thee that they are bad, for they are enemies of life, as are diseases, and death itself. As things are, we have enough of these enemies. We do not need the Christians in addition. Just count them. Diseases, Caesar, Tigellinus, Grisar's poetry, cobblers who govern the descendants of ancient Quirites, freedmen who sit in the Senate, by Castor. There is enough of this. That is a destructive and disgusting sect. Hast thou tried to shake thyself out of this sadness, and make some little use of life?" "I have tried," answered Vinicius. "Ah, traitor," said Petronius, laughing. "News spreads quickly through slaves. Thou hast seduced from me Chrysothemis." Vinicius waved his hand in disgust. "In every case I thank thee," said Petronius. I will send her a pair of slippers embroidered with pearls. In my language of a lover that means, walk away. I owe thee a double gratitude. First, thou didst not accept Eunice. Second, thou hast freed me from Chrysothemis. Listen to me. Thou seest before thee a man who has risen early, bathed, feasted, possessed Chrysothemis, written satires, and even at times interwoven prose with verses, but who has been as wearied as Caesar, and often unable to unfurter himself from gloomy thoughts. And dost thou know why that was so? It was because I sought at a distance that which was near. A beautiful woman is worth her weight always in gold, but if she loves in addition, she has simply no price. Such a one thou wilt not buy with the riches of theirs. I say now to myself as follows. I will fill my life with happiness, as a goblet with the foremost wine which the earth has produced, and I will drink till my hand becomes powerless, and my lips grow pale. What will come, I care not, and this is my latest philosophy. Thou hast proclaimed it always, there is nothing new in it. There is substance, which was lacking." When he had said this, he called Eunice, who entered dressed in white drapery, the former slave no longer, but as it were a goddess of love and happiness. Petronius opened his arms to her, and said, "Om." At this she ran up to him, and, sitting on his knee, surrounded his neck with her arms, and placed her head on his breast. Vinicius saw how a reflection of purple began to cover her cheeks, how her eyes melted gradually in mist. They formed a wonderful group of love and happiness. Petronius stretched his hand to a flat vase standing at one side on a table, and, taking a whole handful of violets, covered with them the head, bosom, and robe of Eunice. Then he pushed the tunic from her arms, and said, "Happy he who, like me, has found love enclosed in such a form. At times it seems to me that we are a pair of gods. Look thyself. Has Praxiteles, or Myron, or Scopas, or Lysias even, created more wonderful lines? Or does there exist in Paros or in Pentelicus such marble as this, warm, rosy, and full of love? There are people who kiss off the edges of vases, but I prefer to look for pleasure where it may be found really." He began to pass his lips along her shoulders and neck. She was penetrated with a quivering. Her eyes now closed, now opened, with an expression of unspeakable delight. Petronius after a while raised her exquisite head, and said, turning to Vinicius, "But think now, what are thy gloomy Christians in comparison with this? And if thou understand not the difference, go thy way to them. But this sight will cure thee." Vinicius distended his nostrils, through which entered the odor of violets, which filled the whole chamber, and he grew pale, for he thought that, if he could have passed his lips along Lygia's shoulders in that way, it would have been a kind of sacrilegious delight so great, that let the world vanish afterward. But accustomed now to a quick perception of that which took place in him, he noticed that at that moment he was thinking of Lygia, and of her only. "Eunice," said Petronius, "give command, thou divine one, to prepare garlands for our heads and a meal." When as he had gone out he turned to Vinicius. "I offered to make her free, but knowest thou what GANSWERED tilde I would rather be thy slave than Caesar's wife? ... and she would not consent. One freed her then without her knowledge. The praetor favored me by not requiring her presence. But she does not know that she is free, as also she does not know that this house and all my jewels, excepting the gems, will belong to her in case of my death." He rose and walked through the room, and said, "Love changes some more, others less, but it has changed even me. Once I loved the odor of verbenas, but as Eunice prefers violets, I like them now beyond all other flowers, and since spring came we breathe only violets." Here he stopped before Vinicius and inquired, "But as to thee, dost thou keep always to nard?" "Give me peace," answered the young man. "I wished thee to see Eunice, and I mentioned her to thee, because thou, perhaps, art seeking also at a distance that which is near. Maybe for thee too is beating, somewhere in the chambers of thy slaves, a true and simple heart. Apply such a balsam to thy wounds. Thou sayest that Lygia loves thee? Perhaps she does. But what kind of love is that which abdicates? Is not the meaning this, that there is another force stronger than her love? No, my dear, Lygia is not Eunice. All is one torment merely," answered Vinicius. I saw thee kissing Eunice's shoulders, and I thought then that, if Lygia would lay hers bare to me, I should not care, if the ground opened under us next moment. But at the very thought of such an act a certain dread seized me, as if I had attacked some vestal, or wished to defile a divinity. Lygia is not Eunice, but I understand the difference not in thy way. Love has changed thy nostrils, and thou preferest violets to verbenas, but it has changed my soul. Hence, in spite of my misery and desire, I prefer Lygia to be what she is, rather than to be like others. In that case no injustice is done thee. But I do not understand the position." "True, true," answered Vinicius, feverishly. "We understand each other no longer." Another moment of silence followed. "May Hades swallow thy Christians," exclaimed Petronius. "They have filled thee with disquiet, and destroyed thy sense of life. May Hades devour them. Thou art mistaken in thinking that their religion is good, for good is what gives people happiness, namely, beauty, love, power, but these they call vanity. Thou art mistaken in this, that they are just. For if we pay good for evil, what shall we pay for good? And besides, if we pay the same for one and the other, why are people to be good? No, the pay is not the same, but according to their teaching it begins in a future life, which is without limit. I do not enter into that question, for we shall see hereafter, if it be possible to see anything without eyes. Meanwhile they are simply incompetents. Ursus strangled Croton, because he has limbs of bronze, but these are motes, and the future cannot belong to motes. For them life begins with death, which is as if one were to say, day begins with night. Apostrophe apostrophe hast thou the intent to carry off Lydia? No, I cannot pay her evil for good, and I swore that I would not. Dost thou intend to accept the religion of Christ? I wish to do so, but my nature cannot endure it. But wilt thou be able to forget Lydia? Then travel. At that moment the slaves announced that the repast was ready, but Petronius, to whom it seemed that he had fallen on a good thought, said, on the way to the triclinium, who has ridden over a part of the world, but only as a soldier hastening to his place of destination, and without halting by the way. Go with us to Achaia. Caesar has not given up the journey. He will stop everywhere on the way, sing, receive crowns, plunder temples, and return as a triumphator to Italy. That will resemble somewhat a journey of Bacchus and Apollo in one person. Augustians, male and female, 1,000 cithers. By Castor, that will be worth witnessing, for hitherto the world has not seen anything like it. Here he placed himself on the couch before the table, by the side of Eunice, and when the slaves put a wreath of anemones on his head, he continued, hat hast thou seen in Corbulo's service? Nothing. I last thou seen the Grecian temples thoroughly, as I have. I who was passing more than 2 years from the hands of one guide to those of another? Hast thou been in Rhodes, to examine the site of the Colossus? Hast thou seen in Panopeus, in Phocis, the clay from which Prometheus shaped man, or in Sparta the eggs laid by Leda, or in Athens the famous Sarmatian armor made of horse hoofs, or in Euxia the ship of Agamemnon, or the cup for whose pattern the left breast of Helen served? Hast thou seen Alexandria, Memphis, the pyramids, the hair which Isis tore from her head in grief for Osiris? Hast thou heard the shout of Memnon? The world is wide. Everything does not end at the Trans-Tiber. I will accompany Caesar, and when he returns I will leave him, and go to Cyprus. For it is the wish of this golden-haired goddess of mine, that we offer doves together to the divinity in Paphos, and thou must know that, whatever she wishes must happen. I am thy slave, said Eunice. He rested his garlanded head on her bosom, and said with a smile, then I am the slave of a slave. I admire thee, divine one, from feet to head. Then he said to Vinicius, Colon, come with us to Cyprus. But first remember that thou must see Caesar. It is bad that thou hast not been with him yet. Tigellinus is ready to use this to thy disadvantage. He has no personal hatred for thee, it is true, but he cannot love thee, even because thou art my sister's son. We shall say that thou wert sick. We must think over what thou art to answer, should he ask thee about Lydia. It will be best to wave thy hand, and say that she was with thee till she wearied thee. He will understand that. Tell him also that sickness kept thee at home, that thy fever was increased by disappointment at not being able to visit Naples, and hear his song, that thou wert assisted to health only by the hope of hearing him. Fear no exaggeration. Tigellinus promises to invent not only something great for Caesar, but something enormous. I am afraid that he will undermine me. I am afraid too of thy disposition. Dost thou know, said Vinicius, that there are people who have no fear of Caesar, and who live as calmly as if he were non-existent? I know whom thou hast in mind, the Christians. Yes, they alone. But our life, what is it, if not unbroken terror? Do not mention thy Christians. They fear not Caesar, because he has not even heard of them perhaps. And in every case he knows nothing of them, and they concern him as much as withered leaves. But I tell thee, that they are incompetents. Thou feelest this thyself. If thy nature is repugnant to their teaching, it is just because thou feelest their incompetence. Thou art a man of other clay, so trouble not thyself or me with them. We shall be able to live and die, and what more they will be able to do is unknown. These words struck Vinicius, and when he returned home, he began to think that in truth, perhaps, the goodness and charity of Christians was a proof of their incompetence of soul. It seemed to him that people of strength and temper could not forgive thus. It came to his head that this must be the real cause of the repulsion which his Roman soul felt toward their teaching. We shall be able to live and die, said Petrus. As to them, they know only how to forgive, and understand neither true love nor true hatred. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.